132 on the 27th, presents Senator Elton, Senator Wilken, myself, Chair Dyson. The other people aren't here because they don't give a rip. I don't think that's true. I think they're just a little late on a busy day. First order of business is the HB 225. Are you ready, Representative McGuire?
Thank you so much, Senator Dyson. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. I think it's a really important bill for all of Alaska. presently, Mr. Chairman and members of the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee here in the Senate. Last year alone, there were over 1,100 cases filed with the state of Alaska's medical examiner office. We have only one state medical examiner to handle that entire load. His duties are multifaceted. Obviously, one of the most important as a medical doctor is performing the very complicated autopsies involved. But he also has other duties. He's got to go testify in court if it's a suspicious death. There's no way to enter that evidence without the ability to cross-examine the medical examiner. So he's got that along with administrative duties, and he does it all on his own. Why this becomes an important public issue, Mr. Chairman, is that a lot of the autopsies that are investigated are of a suspicious nature. And that's important to Alaskans because we don't think it's a good public policy that you ought to be able to kill your neighbor and not come to reckoning with that, frankly. And without enough folks in that office to examine these suspicious deaths, that's what we're doing. Law enforcement has come to me with this concern over the years that, frankly, there have been unusual or unexplained circumstances that just have to fall off the rolls. Because there isn't enough manpower. The other area that should concern all of Alaska is the places where contagious diseases are present. Certainly with the bird flu and some of these other viruses that we see spreading around the world and how quickly they spread, Alaska is a gateway for many of the Asian countries and so on. So we want our state medical examiner to be able to investigate these cases and do an autopsy immediately to discover whether or not there's a contagious disease present that might impact public health. So I don't think I need to go into the practical part of it, Mr. Chairman. There's one person for the entire state of Alaska. Many of my colleagues in the Fairbanks region and the Southeast region and so on have talked about the frustration that they have experienced in trying to advocate on behalf of their constituents to try to get some of these autopsies done when the one medical examiner in Anchorage has got to get on a plane and fly many miles away, and oftentimes it comes too late. So there's that aspect. Certainly he's a human being, and so there's the opportunity for him to fall ill or to have to leave his duties for any number of reasons, family tragedies or so on, and that leaves nobody at the helm. So with due respect, I submit this forward to you. I think it's a good policy. Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to micromanage too much, and so what we're saying in the bill is simply we need one medical examiner and we need one deputy. Beyond that, we leave the may in there, and if there is the will and the money at some other point to further build up this office as need be, that's the will of the legislatures and the operating budget and certainly the commissioner of HESS. But I do think it's important that we at least have two. So that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative McGuire. So the state could have increased the staff without this legislation, is that correct?
Yes.
And but you're mandating now that they move from one to two. Is this additional position reflected in the governor's budget?
Mr. Chairman, it is reflected in the House's version. and I believe it will be reflected in the ultimate version that comes out of the conference committee. That's why there's a zero fiscal note.
Yeah, I was confused by that.
And so, so it was an additional $100,000 was put in for this position, and the arguments were made and well accepted in our body. I think from conversations, and you've got the co-chairman of finance here, but from conversations with members of your body, it may well have even been an oversight that the importance of this particular position as a line item wasn't called the attention wasn't called to it in time, and you and I spoke about it at one point. It's in conference committee right now, and I have obviously the commitment from my two co-chairmen of the importance of it. And then I guess just on the part about mandating, I would say this. I'm not generally in the business of creating more government positions, but I think there are a few very important places in our government where you see this should be the state's role. And this is one of those places, with all due respect. I would not want this position contracted out, and I wouldn't want it unfilled. I think that it's a matter of public health, and I think it's the kind of thing that when you're looking at the role of the government, you say this is an appropriate place for a government official. You can think about a situation, for example, in public health where, let's say a pharmaceutical company were at the root of some kind of series of unexplained deaths. That were then examined by our medical examiner that has a duty to the citizens of Alaska, that's appropriate. What if this individual were, for example, for hire? I worry about those situations. And so this is probably the first and only time you'll ever see me doing something like this, but I think it's for a good reason.
I appreciate that. I see we have Dr. Munsager on the line. Can you hear us, Doc?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Does the administration have taken a position on this bill?
For the record, I'm Dr. Munsager, Director of the Division of Public Health. We've taken a record position of supporting the bill. The only tiny bit of difference I would say from what Representative McGuire said was that the reason we submitted a zero fiscal note is that our budget currently does have just enough money for a minimal operation of with two medical examiners. And we have gone now about 6 months with a vacancy while we're recruiting. We currently in practice have practice for a medical examiner position and another medical examiner in practice. We've appointed that person as a deputy. Now this bill will say we shall appoint it as a medical examiner. The reason we in the governor's budget included a $100,000 increment was to begin building the capacity of the medical examiner's office to more fully meet all of those missions that Representative McGuire talked about, and hopefully begin moving us toward the third mission beyond the friendly mission number one, number two, which is infection agent mission, the public health mission, and the third is being able to answer some questions of loved ones as to why their loved one died. But that'll take us to get into the May language in this bill that eventually we would have to, as a state, reach agreement that we did it funded with three medical examiners. But for now, this bill just raises the ante for us as a position that we shall have to chief medical examiner and deputy.
All right. And so if I understand it, you support it, you're in the process of recruiting someone because you saw the need and that the governor's budget as submitted had enough funds in it to fund the position that you're currently recruiting for. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. But I would echo what Representative McGuire said, is the increment was to more fully support that second position so it could be more fully functional.
Any questions for Dr. Munsager? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Dr. Munsager, for joining us. The first question I've got is this not only provides that you shall have a deputy, but it also sets up the recipe of what that deputy's duties are. And I know that you have the ability to now possibly have a deputy, and I'm assuming that if you did have a deputy now, that you would set up the duties for the deputy rather than have them set up in law as is occurring here?
Representative Elton, through the chair, I think the answer would be correct. The other difference from what this bill would do is that it's conceivable under current statute that we would have a chief and we would recruit for a second person that might not be qualified for a deputy. We currently are recruiting for somebody, and the people we're talking to are qualified to be a deputy, and this bill will say we shall do that.
Okay, a follow-up question, or maybe a slightly different question. We heard the sponsor talk about her preference obviously being an additional deputy, but I'd be interested in whether or not the department had looked at the idea of having contract physicians available in different regions of the state to perform the duties assigned to your office now, and whether or not that is a viable option that potentially could save costs?
Senator Elton, to the chair, I think Dr. Fallop was online. I might make just a brief initial comment and then let him add his comments on that. In the year that I've been here, we have talked about that, about are there any other qualified people in our state who could function, say, part-time as a medical examiner. And there is one individual in one part of the state where we've been talking about for at least some part-time service. The qualifications becomes a key issue with this. Maybe Dr. Fallopo could comment on that.
Yes, Representative Elton, through the chair. This is Dr. Fallopo, Chief Medical Examiner. The standards of performance nationally have increased, and I've tried to implement those increases through the office by doing better autopsies, if you will. The problem with this work is we cannot contract with a hospital-based pathologist unless they have had the same training and certification as I have, for example. Hospital-based pathology is very different, and so the only people, really, who would be qualified here, number two, one in Anchorage and the other in Juneau, we have actively tried to recruit the individual from Juneau who's a highly qualified forensic and hospital pathologist. I don't think that will be possible, although he hasn't told me no yet. The problem is that he has a hospital-based private practice, and the state can't meet his needs so that he could do both jobs. Otherwise, there is no one else here qualified to the degree that we need to perform the kind of work, the level of work, to a standard, if you will, that would be required.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Doctor.
You're welcome.
This is Dyson. It's been reported to me that we may be missing some the cause of some accidental deaths just because I don't have the manpower to do the autopsy, and the particular ones were carbon monoxide deaths and from people in remote locations running generators and vessel exhaust, either when they have a following wind or hanging on the anchor and a genset running. Do you have any thoughts on that one?
Dyson, through the chair, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, we have investigated those deaths very thoroughly, and when autopsy is required, we do them. I do not believe that we have missed any of those deaths. However, I will say that they are very difficult death determinations sometimes, and they can be missed even under the best of circumstances. We have a problem with transportation of bodies and doing this sort of work within our budgets. However, we have special sensitivity to carbon monoxide deaths. As you know, there have been quite a few of them here under tragic circumstances, and I do not believe that we have missed any of them. However, one sometimes doesn't know what one misses, if you will. And we certainly would have a better opportunity to pick up those accidental deaths that I am now deferring if indeed we had one more medical examiner here. You know, this office really can't run with one examiner because I am stretched to the point where I have to triage or turn away cases that perhaps would be done in other jurisdictions, other good jurisdictions. But I do not believe, summing up, that we have missed any carbon monoxide deaths that would reach a level of suspicion that others would disapprove of, for example, turning the case down.
All right, thank you. The other category that's intriguing, I understand that you sometimes get requests from families that are outside whose elderly family member has died under circumstances that are interesting because of recent changes in their wills and estates, and that you sometimes get requests to try to figure out the cause of death in those. Would you comment on that, sir?
Yes, Senator Dice, through the chair. My comment is that the autopsy is like any other laboratory test. Other doctors order lab tests. I order an autopsy in the same way, if indicated. In forensic cases, a forensic autopsy often is done if it will help the entire case. It is not done at the request of family, for example, or even at the request of police or troopers, unless we both agree. And sometimes if I disagree, I'll compromise for a variety of reasons. In those cases you were referring to, the investigation and other events clearly showed that the requester had a vested interest and was manufacturing, if you will, information such that their bias might be dealt with in dealing with civil law cases, for example, or that some of the requests, some of the demands, indeed, were not warranted. And so what I always do is work through the proper police or trooper agencies to see if the investigation really warrants an autopsy. And in the cases where no autopsy is warranted, I don't do them at the request of families, because that is not the purpose of this office, and it is not why this office is set up. There's a basic misunderstanding about that, and indeed sometimes families who don't have these issues will call and want an autopsy at state expense, but that just can't be done, certainly not with present staffing or even with two medical examiners.
Senator Dyson, this is Dr. Montier. Could I make a follow-on comment?
Sure.
I think what Dr. Palafin just said is kind of an elaboration of what I said earlier, is that in the future, I think the legislature can expect me to continue talking about this issue, and if and when administration and the legislature reaches agreement about expansion of the staff of the office of emergency in the national talk about medical examiner's office, that's probably the ideal, but very few medical examiner's offices are funded to be able to perform that.
Okay, so if an elderly citizen dies, it doesn't trigger a police presence, and I think all it requires is a physician or some other qualified person to sign a death certificate. Is that right?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I assume the question was directed to me, Dr. Falico. If the death is a natural death that occurs at a hospital, it does not trigger any input from this office, and another physician or person will sign the death certificate. If that same death occurs outside of this office, there are two ways that it is handled. The first way is that the police, in fact, will go to the home with a 911 call or whatever, and they will investigate and determine very quickly it's a natural death. That death will be reported to me, and then I make a determination about the cause and the manner of death, and I sign the death certificate. The great majority of time, that does not require an autopsy. If the family asks me for one, I say I can't do it. We don't provide that service. I do refer them to a private pathologist who can provide the service at a fee to the family. The second way it'll happen is so-called expected home death, where paperwork is set up in advance, and that is meant to be smooth such that there is no real investigation by police, and we just log that death in our records, and of course no autopsy is done. Sometimes on the expected home deaths, however, the troopers disagree and they actually go and investigate the case, but still nothing happens regarding our office except the paperwork is filled out.
All right, but this is Dyson again, but if it's not in a hospital, but say it's in a assisted living home or a private home where there's hospice care, does the cops still have to show up when there's a death?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that depends on if it is reported or not and on the individual circumstances. For example, so-called assisted living or nursing home deaths, if you will, push a very sensitive button, not only for me but for the police, because of recent events that I'm sure you're aware about and about issues having to do with elder abuse. So in some cases, certainly the police would show up. Here in Anchorage, the police do not show up, and that was the purpose, the original intent of the expected home death paperwork. However, where the troopers' jurisdictions lie, at least in some of those jurisdictions, they insist on going to the scene. I've had them call me from time to time wondering why they have to do it, and I tell them as far as I'm concerned, they do not. However, their supervisors tell them they have to, so that's the way it's run now. But in any case, I review the paperwork and make an independent determination about the cause and manner of death, and I will take some of those cases in, for example, if they die in certain nursing homes, and do an autopsy just because of the political, if you will, and or public, plus the legal pressure that may be applied later on that I might not know about at the time.
Yeah, so, and I appreciate that. So here's a scenario that I heard of. 87-year-old man who's been non-ambulatory for 6 or 8 years and arguably not only incompetent, but and then miraculously decides to marry his 29-year-old personal care attendant, whose boyfriend is the supervising physician, and 2 weeks after the magic marriage, ups and dies, but in the interim, the will has been changed, and but arguably, he dies of natural causes, and the supervising physician signs the death certificate. Is there anything in our process that looks at recent changes in status, like marriage or wills, that might get you or the troopers' attention that maybe this case needs a little more looking at?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, Dr. Palico. The answer to your question is we are not a primary investigating agency for the most part. And so what I do when I hear about a case like this, or family members call and complain or others complain, is I refer directly to the primary investigative agency, for example, the troopers, and I say, look, you guys have the knowledge and experience about investigating this death. If you need me, I'll go. If you fly me there or tell me where I can drive to if it's fairly close, and help. And in all cases I've been involved with, that is what happened, and the feedback I get is there is no suspicion of the interaction of another person in this death. There is no reason why there should be criminal charges forthwith and so forth. And so those cases may or may not be done by me, depending upon other circumstances.
Okay. I suspect that, well, so my question was, but in a case like that that looks normal, no one in authority goes to look at recent changes in will or things like that automatically, unless the other errors call and alert you. Is that correct?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, Dr. Palco. Well, my belief is that the police investigators or trooper investigators, in fact, would do that because that is part of their job, and I would openly discuss that, and they have discussed it with me in at least one case of a recent will change where there were suspicions that, as a matter of fact, a criminal act may have been committed to obtain money or something else. However, on one particular case, you may be referring to that case, what the investigational information proved to be was that the family members doing all the complaining hadn't been in contact with the decedent for many, many years, and it appeared to be, at least on the surface, an attempt to grab some money very quickly about a relationship change that they disapproved of but didn't know that much about. Now, on the surface, it seemed strange initially because there was a very short relationship before that union occurred. And, of course, it brings up the same question in my mind as it would with you. But, again, I have to rely on the police or trooper investigation. If they're not willing to push forward on this, then of course I can't independently look at wills and so forth. And if another doctor signs a death certificate, that doctor would be responsible for making a determination of the cause and manner of death.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any questions for Dr. Manzager or Dr. Flacio? Senator Wilkin. Brief at ease.
My comments are addressed to the doctor and to Representative McGuire. I guess I'm a little puzzled as to why we have to have a bill. The governor this year has staked his claim very clearly that the separation of powers is near and dear to his heart. In fact, he's vetoed some appropriations because of separation of powers. So I suspect this bill, should it pass the legislature, is subject to veto. So my question is, if it's vetoed, doctor, or it doesn't pass the legislature, and if there's such a need for this, why does this have to be carried by a legislator and not just come from the executive branch, which is responsible for managing the state? Why do we need a bill? And if the bill doesn't pass or is vetoed, if it does pass, can't you just go ahead and do this if you deem it to be appropriate and necessary?
This is Dr. Bonsager. Maybe I'll take a shot at answering that first, and Representative McGuire can have her opinion. I think the reason that this bill was brought forward by Representative McGuire and others was because they felt we hadn't paid enough attention to filling, making sure we kept the two positions filled. That's my supposition on my part. I think the answer to your second question is that if the bill doesn't pass, we will continue to try and staff the office with two medical examiners as per the current budgetary amount, as I testified to. I do think this bill, didn't think about it, frankly. I do think it is a bit of an improvement over current practice in that it really does state very clearly that we as a state need, as a minimum, two medical examiners. My personal opinion is that's a correct statement, but this would put it in statute rather than being my opinion or the opinion of somebody, my successor in the future.
Okay, thank you. I worry about the governor being consistent and making sure that if this is a separation of powers issue, I just have to ask Representative McGuire if she's thought about getting 45 votes for a veto override. It's just one of those things we'll have to think about. But if indeed it doesn't pass or it's vetoed by the governor, I suspect and the executive branch thinks they need a second or a third or a fourth, that's their job to do that. And they should do it. So, but that's my comments. Thank you.
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilkin, it's, as you know, and I see your point that you're making. It's not uncommon for the legislature to set out in our statute a series of standards and areas that we want. The money has to come from us ultimately, and that's our branch of government. But it isn't uncommon for us to do it, and it's not uncommon for us to do it even within the departments of the executive branch. There is precedent for it. And then secondly, I would just say that I do respect what you have to say, and as I had said earlier, I tread lightly in this area, but I do think it's a matter of such importance that it should be in statute. And the concern that I have, Senator Wilkin, is that when you look back at the history, it's been an interesting one. There was a point in time where the medical examiner office had as many as five physicians throughout the state that were doing autopsies. We were rated in the top tier of medical examiner offices in the United States. And over the years, we simply have eliminated those positions, or they've fallen off, and we've not filled them. Dr. Monsanger, I think, is one of the superior public health directors we've had. And he's got this broad background and this real true understanding of medicine and science and the importance. So I don't doubt that he's going to continue pursuing this, and I certainly appreciate his support of my bill, but I'd really like to have it in our laws, the collection of policies that, we think are important, not just now under Dr. Monsonger's term and tenure, but into the future. And I don't have any reason to believe that the governor would veto this bill. In fact, I have every reason to believe he'll sign it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. While the sponsor is at the table, Mr. Chair, on page 3, line 19, I'm wondering if there's not a drafting error and whether or not that language should say medical examiner or the deputy medical examiner. Insert the word or.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, absolutely. That was just pointed out. Throughout the bill, it says or. The drafter chose a comma there. I don't know why, but I think that's inappropriate.
Mr. Chair, do you need a motion to insert or?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I move that on page 3, line 19, after examiner, comma, we insert the word or.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill is amended. The amendment is accepted, and the bill is amended. Any further questions? All right. Well, off the record. One more person to testify, Dr. Don Rogers, who was the former state medical examiner. Doc, this is Dyson. We have the votes to move this bill, and with or without your testimony, but if you want to testify, we'd sure be glad to hear it. We do have lots of work today, so your option, sir.
Well, I would like to make a couple comments.
Go for it.
I'm in support of this bill, of course, because they need more help down there, but it's going to take a change of policy from Dr. Monsonger to make this office work better. And I'm not intending this as a criticism of Dr. Palico because he's trying to do the best he can when he's all alone. But ideally, we should be doing autopsies on all, quote, coroner's cases, unquote, because if you rely upon the testimony, or if you will, or of witnesses and the troopers and the police department, you're going to be misled frequently. I can think of several cases where the story that came with the body was not corroborated by the autopsy findings, and everything has to mesh before you can sign a case out. There's a requirement, I think, to accurately determine the cause and manner of death, and it's embodied in the word certify or certificate. The death certificate requires one to certify what somebody died of. I've been told by my lawyer friends that the word certify is kind of like being under oath. And if you don't do the examination, then and you sign out without looking at the body, then you're going to be wrong a good share of the time. So ideally, all these cases should be done. And I think that there's a public service function in the medical examiner's office where we should be doing cases to alleviate the anxieties of the families. It's not just to find, just to find the bullet holes in a homicide. There's more to this job than that. And I realize that Dr. Bell and I disagree on this point. We've talked it over many times. In the past, two of us did all the autopsies in the state when there were around 1,000 or so. And we did a briefer exam than is done now. But we don't necessarily weigh the kidneys, for example, because it's not relevant most of the time. The other thing that the lab needs is a toxicology lab that Dr. Palico can have some control over. One of the easiest tests in the lab is carbon monoxide, and they don't even have capability of doing that, I guess. or at least it's been reported, they send even COs outside. Just this morning I was in on a case, it's a civil case where carbon monoxide should have been done but was not, although the specimen is still available, I guess. I hope it is anyway. But the office ought to try to foresee some of these civil cases and be prepared to answer the questions that arise.
Dr. Rogers, Senator Elton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, thanks. I'm of a rather delicate, I have a delicate nature, so I don't want you to get too graphic. But, I mean, when there's a death, for example, in the hospital, is the medical examiner's office brought into, I mean, would you normally provide an autopsy, or would that, would you accept the doctor's certification that may be affiliated with the hospital?
If it's a natural death and, you know, a cancer patient, something like that, we would accept the attending physician. But there are cases that I think are mentioned in the law which involve deaths under anesthesia or deaths that occur very shortly after admission that are apparently due to other than natural causes, that where the medical examiner would take a hospital death and evaluate it.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, is that a matter of the medical examiner's discretion, or are they automatically kicked into the purview of the medical examiner by law?
Under the old law, they were automatically went to the medical examiner, but he could take the word of the physicians, for example, let them sign it out. But they were required, the old law said that these various cases had to be, quote, investigated, unquote, and the investigation might or might not include an autopsy. But when I was there, we did them all, not the in-hospital deaths, we did the ones that were anesthetic related or appeared to be a medical error or something like that, then we did them. That was because most of the time the physicians and the families wanted someone independent of the hospital to do it. And I still get occasional ones like that. I quit doing this about a dozen years ago because I was instructed to quit doing so many autopsies because of costs, I guess. And my thought then was that if the Dr. Monsager's predecessor, whose name I can't come up with at the moment, but if he wanted cases signed out, he could sign them out himself. He was an MD, and he could make the guess just as well as I could. And, of course, that didn't go over well, and I wound up resigning. But I still think that in a state as small as ours, with as few deaths as we have, it's possible to do at least most of them, if not all. In a place like Los Angeles County, where 15 years ago there were 30 or 35,000 bodies a year going through that office, they couldn't do them all. There are not enough hours in the day. But Alaska is not like that. We can do them all. And I think that should be the ultimate goal, is to go back to doing the autopsies maybe more briefly than they do now. But if you think somebody had a coronary, it doesn't take very long to corroborate that.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Any other questions? Thank you for your timeless efforts on behalf of the state and the ferreting out the causes of death. I should have noted for the record that about 2:30-2:40, Senator Olson joined us. Is there any questions, more questions, or discussion on this bill? If not, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only question I have is that, and I'm not sure who to ask the question of. It talks about on page 2, line 2, it talks about the education experience in forensic pathology. I'm assuming the education means the medical school graduate as well as an intern or a residency and experience in forensic pathology. I was wondering, was there a quantity of years that need to be fulfilled for this?
Dr. Monsager, did you hear that question?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I did, and probably Dr. Falico is in a better position to answer that question.
Dr. Fascio?
Falico, yes. Senator Olson,
Chair. The answer is to be fully qualified as a forensic pathologist, certified in the subspecialty of forensic pathology, one must go to medical school, obtain an MD or a DO degree, followed by at least certification in anatomic pathology, which is a branch of pathology, and that takes 2 to 3 years, followed then by certification in forensic pathology, and that's an additional year of training. Now, another way to do it would be to become certified in anatomic pathology and clinical pathology, like I am, followed by another year of forensic pathology. So you know there's a long, arduous course for getting there, many years, and for a variety of reasons that I will get into, very, very few people go into this field. There are about 300 fully qualified forensic pathologists practicing in the country full-time. Those are the numbers. So with these great shortages and so forth, what I'm talking about are the top-rated people. It is possible that people with lesser training can do this work, but we've all read about the disasters across the country, medical examiners' offices, where less than well-qualified people perform the work. And what we've done is set the highest standards here, no matter what, because I don't want to go back to the old ways of doing partial autopsies, of not weighing certain organs and having my reports reflect that. Certain things that in the past may have been acceptable, but today I would be criticized for. When I get up on the stand, you all probably know, you read about what I do. I was just down there in Juneau earlier this week, and I'm under a very, very detailed cross-examination with experts that are flown up here by the defense and others to certify, you know, my work and to try and attack it. And so I feel what we need are fully qualified people, as I've described in those qualifications.
My last question, Mr. Chairman, is that how does this apply to foreign medical graduates? And obviously, there are pathologists there.
Is that question for me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Dr. Palico.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Again, Senator Olson, to the chair. For example, I am a foreign medical graduate. I graduated from the University of Bologna many years ago, one of the most famous universities in the world. As long as that graduate passes the qualifications in order to practice medicine in the United States and specifically holds a valid, a bona fide state license, then the foreign medical graduate is just as qualified as anyone else. Now, in recent years, there are many fewer foreign medical graduates coming to this country for a variety of reasons that I won't get into. So really, it is a non-issue. If a qualified candidate were to apply for this position, that candidate would have the same chances, depending upon the total qualifications, as if that person graduated from an American medical school.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? The chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I, like Senator Elton, have a very delicate nature, so it's with some trepidation that I fear that this is going to the governor's guillotine, but with that fear, I would move House Bill 225 from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill moves. Thank you. We'll now take up HB 120. Representative Wilson. Please present your bill.
Representative Peggy Wilson, and I am the sponsor of House Bill 120, and this bill actually repeals two exemptions from the Alaska blood.
Hold the mic closer, please.
This bill repeals two exemptions from the Alaska's bloodborne pathogen protection standards to bring Alaska standards up into compliance with federal standards. And in 2000, we adopted in Alaska here, adopted our bloodborne pathogen regulations. And in 2001, the feds adopted theirs. And actually, overall, we are, our regulations are stronger and a little more tighter than the federal regulations are, except that there are two two areas where Alaska doesn't comply with the federal standards, and those are where dental offices are concerned, or offices, any kind of health care office that has less than 25 full-time employees. So all this bill is really a housekeeping bill that rolls, makes sure that our statutes are equal to the federal guidelines, and mainly so that we can qualify for certain federal grants.
All right, and I think in the packet there's a letter from the Dental Society or Association, Alaska Dental Society, endorsing what you're doing here. Has the medical community weighed in on this one?
Actually, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development supports it. The Nurses Association supports it. The Alaska Dental Hygienists, the Alaska Dental Society, and we have no one that I know of that's against it.
But the Alaska Medical Association.
They haven't made a comment one way or another.
All right. Senator Olson?
Actually, that was my question, Mr. Chairman. I just want to know where the Alaska State Medical Association or the Alaska Physicians and Surgeons Association stood on the bill. But you already answered it. They've not made a comment.
All right. Any questions for this bill sponsor? Dr. Beth Funk from the Department of Health and Social Services is online to answer any questions. Do you have any comments, Doc?
This is Dr. Funk, Beth Funk. No, I don't. I'm just available for any questions.
All right. Is it your experience that there's no one you know of in the medical community that is taking exception to this? All right. Thank you. I have two other people that want to testify. Gray Mitchell, Department of Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the Director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division at Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And my division is charged with enforcing occupational safety and health requirements associated with medical facilities and dentist's office and other locations. And currently, we're having some difficulty with our federal counterparts who provide us with grant funds to carry out our program. And that is specifically because under the agreement that the Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Program was created under in 1970, we agreed that we would maintain standards that were at least as effective as federal standards. And this is an area where we're not meeting the minimum federal standards because we're exempting dental offices and small medical offices. So to kind of straighten that out, we've taken those two exemptions off of the list, and essentially we haven't heard any negative comments. The dental community has come out and supported the bill. Small medical offices haven't voiced any opposition to it, and our in the field personnel in the industrial hygiene area have essentially been guiding these businesses toward compliance with federal requirements already, and the overwhelming consensus is that they are already in compliance with federal standards. It's a common sense issue.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Elton?
A comment, and maybe the representative from the Department of Labor can either agree with what I'm going to say or see if I fundamentally misunderstand. And part of my sordid history, Mr. Chair, is that I was a sponsor of the bill that passed in 2000 that created the needle stick program.
I remember.
And one of the issue, I mean, we made a series of decisions as the bill went through to make sure that we could get something on the books. And one of the decisions was to exempt dental. The other was to provide an employee cap. But my understanding now is it probably shouldn't matter to anybody because, in fact, the federal rules and regulations don't care about the size of the office and do provide that dentists are covered. Is that correct? So that what we're doing isn't going to aggrieve anybody any more than they're already aggrieved by federal regulations.
Through the chair, that's correct.
All right.
And that may be why we're not hearing from the medical community, because they have to follow that rule anyway.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. John?
Mr. Chairman and Senators, my name is John Bitney, and I'm under contract and registered as a lobbyist with the Alaska Nurses Association. I had a nurse scheduled to come and support it, but she had an allergy issue with a child and asked me just to come and express support for the bill. And thank you very much.
Nurses Association says amen. Okay. All right. Any questions for John? All right. Thank you. Any further discussion, questions? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, has there been a problem that has caused us or caused this to come to light? You know, has anybody gotten had a clinical difficulty, either a disease from something like viral hepatitis, and or any other virus for that matter, that prompted this?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, not that I'm aware of. This is just something that needs to be taken care of. There's because of the fact that these regulations are, you know, life and death issues. People don't want to get AIDS. They don't want to get hepatitis, and so the practitioners are very, very careful, because they not only want to protect themselves, but they want to protect their patients. And so it's something that's automatically almost done for everybody's protection without even saying that it has to be done, because it's a common sense issue, you know, because of it is a life and death issue.
My last question, Mr. Chairman, what's the added burden that's going to be on, say, smaller clinics that aren't even complying with this as well right now?
Actually, the impact of this legislation is not expected to be significant at all, for two reasons. One is that the businesses currently exempt under the Alaska law are already complying with the federal requirements, and the participation required for the frontline healthcare workers in the evaluation process, that's something they automatically do too, and they're just supposed to be kind of trying to stay up with accepted standards of practice. You know, if there's a new needle, someone invents a new way for that protection to happen, and when you give an injection, the needle, like right now, if you give an injection, that needle automatically just withdraws and disappears so that no one could accidentally get stuck with it. It's just that to keep up with what the current accepted practices are, so that we're always at the top, you know, trying to be at the front of protection for everyone.
Yes, I do have one more question, Mr. Chairman. That has to do with how does this affect the health aides out in Bush, Alaska, that, first of all, are minimally trained and many times don't have the latest equipment out there. In fact, I went to a village a year or two ago, and there was a laceration that asked me to stitch up, and there wasn't even sterile suture material out there for that. How does this affect them? That's my question.
You know, I'm not sure. I would assume that they are required, or as you know, to be trained. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that would fall back under the umbrella of who is in charge of them and who oversees what they do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Off the record, Senator Wilkin.
I had a technical amendment, but we'll talk about it later. Yeah. I thought it's important for the record, Peggy, that you tell the committee your professional background and as it pertains to this legislation.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, I am a registered nurse by profession, and I also, before I came to the legislature, was an EMT3 and worked with an ambulance squad and went on runs all the time. So I personally understand the importance of protection for yourself and your patients.
But that was important for the record, and ready for a motion?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, move to report House Bill 120 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill is moved.
Thank you very much.
We'll now take up our
I think you ought to read it aloud, is what I.
Our confirmations. Hey, are you campaigning over there? Are you campaigning over there?
Just for the NPRA.
Shaking hands with everybody.
So we should, we're expecting a bunch of...
All right. Back on the record, we will now deal with our confirmations. The first one we have today is Cam Carlson, who is wanting to serve on the Board of Psychological and Psychological Associate Examiners. Can you hear us, Pam?
Yes, I can. It's Cam, C-A-M.
Yeah, thank you. We have your resume. Please tell us why you'd like to serve in this capacity.
Well, there was an opening on the board, and I was invited to apply for that, and I did so because I had an interest in this area most of my life, having had some relatives who had problems in this area, the impact of some of the problems in this area on education and school children.
And it just seemed like a good place to serve. So, let's see. You are a public member for this board?
Yes.
All right. All right, thank you. I note you're from Fairbanks.
Right.
Any questions for Cam? My packet's the last one on the bottom. All right, any questions for Camille? If not, thank you for your willingness to serve and your long-standing contributions here in Alaska. Thank you.
Okay.
Do we have anybody else online yet? All right, we'll take a brief ease until we wait. Have one of our nominees for the Board of Regents, Carl Mars. Can you hear us, Carl?
I sure can.
Where are you?
I'm in Anchorage in my office right now.
All right. So, Carl, we have your resume, and I think all of us are familiar with the work that you've done in the state for a long time. Can you tell us why you'd like to serve on the Board of Regents?
Trying to raise monies for scholarships and building the Surrey Scholarship Fund. I'd like to see that put to good use. I also think that the University of Alaska, in my mind, can be one of the premier research centers for the North Pacific, not only Arctic, but offshore fisheries, and just the North Pacific in general, and any university. Country. We've got one of the most powerful computer systems. We ought to be using it for these kind of things. There's a lot of things that I think the university could do that helps the state in research as far as oil and gas resources of other types besides fisheries. And, you know, we're just positioned, I think, in a great environment to be able to assist the state. And I'm not sure that that focus has been brought there yet. Plus, you know, I think there are some problems that, you know, we need to work on.
Thank you. Any questions for Carl? Well, thanks for all the work you've done to pass, Carl. We look forward to you working on in this capacity, and I think I speak for all of the legislators that if you see things that we need to know to help the university do its job better, please let us know.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, as you know me pretty well, I'm not shy about raising issues. So,
okay. All right. Thank you for your willingness to serve, Carl.
You're welcome. I will see you tomorrow.
You bet.
Okay. Bye.
Give our best to your wife and her family.
Will do.
All right. Thank you. Bye. We'll next go to Mary Mundell. Can you hear us?
This is Mary.
Yeah, Mary, and we have your resume, and I understand you're interested in serving on the Board of Pharmacy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, would you please tell us why?
Well, it's important to me as a new business owner here in Wasilla. I've been here for 3 years as a business owner, that I think that I can bring a diverse interest to the Board of Pharmacy. I have an extensive background in pharmacy, very diverse, as you can see from my resume. So I think that I offer a unique position to the Board of Pharmacy because I'm not only a pharmacist, but I also am a business owner.
I appreciate that. And you have not served on this board before, is that correct?
No, sir, I have not.
Yeah, so I'm going to indulge myself a little bit and ask you about an issue that's been before the Board of Pharmacy this last 2 years, and that has to do with delegation of prescriptive authority and blanket prescriptions. Are you familiar with that issue?
I believe I am.
Yeah, what's your position on that, Mary?
It's a very difficult position to be because there is numerous states have a collaborative practice agreement with physicians. It's not problematic in a pharmacist and a physician having a collaborative practice agreement. It's probably very helpful to the public. It just depends on what the scope of that's going to entail. Is it going to just be one or two small areas, or is it going to include every type of prescriptive authority that a physician has? And I think that's where the Board of Pharmacy is going to be very, very involved in defining what that collaborative practice agreement will be.
Yeah, so the specific issue that we got wrapped up here was a doctor giving, it appeared to be blanket authority for pharmacists to give out prescriptions where there was no relationship between the client, patient, and that physician. And that's what there was a real problem about, and I think that the State Medical Board is taking a more rigorous position on that, and my sense is the State Pharmacy Board as well. But do you believe that there should be a direct relationship between the patients and the physician who is delegating prescriptive authority?
I think that's very important to do that. The only time I can see where that would be very difficult to do is if you've got somebody way in the bush, and you know that's always a very different situation to be in anyway. So that's kind of, you know, Alaska is such a diverse area. You've got people that are way out, people that are located right in town. But I do believe that a physician and a pharmacist and the patient have to have some sort of interaction with each other before something can be prescribed or just blanketly given out, or might as well just, you know, go get it off the internet or something. Because that's been one of the main problems with the internet. Nobody sees a physician. Nobody talks to the pharmacist.
Yeah, your answer certainly is satisfactory to me. Are there any questions for Mary? I personally appreciate the fact that you've been on the business end as well and understand those dynamics. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Mary, and thanks for your willingness to serve.
Oh, you bet. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll go next to Margaret Lowe. Can you hear us, Margaret?
I can hear you now, yes.
Yeah, and you're wanting to be on the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees?
That's right.
All right. Well, we have your resume. Please tell us why you'd like to serve in this capacity.
Well, I was first in love with the trust back in 1962 when I first started working with disabled people and families in Alaska. And at that time, the trust was set up, and we were not going to have any financial worries at all. And so I thought that was wonderful, and I followed and watched, and then watched through the 70s when the trust was sort of obliterated by the legislature. So I became very interested then when the lawsuit was filed in the mid-80s, and I stayed very involved then as that suit was won, and began to set up to develop the legislation to have the Mental Health Trust again, be a part of our total program for persons who experience disabilities and the four beneficiary groups that fall under that. And I was fortunate, I was in Juneau from 1991 to 95, so that was when a lot of the work was being done on the trust. And I've just been always very excited about it. I think it's a very, very fine way to fund, and it will continue, I think, to grow and will, again, be a great contributor to having the resources to provide the kinds of programs that we know we are capable of doing for the four beneficiary groups in the state of Alaska. And I think as far as my service on the trust as a trustee, I feel like I've had a good handle for these last 45 years at least on what's been happening for persons with special needs, and I think I can contribute from that aspect.
You certainly have the experience. Are there any questions for Margaret? All right. Thank you, Margaret, and thank you for your past service and your willingness to bring your expertise and experience to this board.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for your consideration.
All right. You're welcome. We'll go now to Bonnie Gaborik. Did I pronounce that right, Bonnie?
I'm sorry. It's Gaborik.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
All right. All right, you want to be on the Professional Teaching Practices Commission?
Yes, I would.
Yeah, right. Tell us why.
Well, you know, I've been involved at the elementary level in education all for close to 30 years now, and I'm a specialist in generalist, although I do generally speaking, and I've held several levels of administrative jobs, and now I am also a principal. And over the years, I've had the experience of working with all different levels of administrators and teachers and families and students. And if nothing else, teaching is about ethics. And the most important thing our profession can do is police our own ranks. I don't know how to say it any better than that. I listened to a presentation by Bonnie Barber last spring when she was in Fairbanks and was very fascinated by the whole process of how Alaska handles complaints that are filed both against teachers and rightly so, and then possibly wrongly so. I just thought, you know, that's the way I can continue to be involved in education. It just caught my eye. I was very interested in it. I thought I could handle the meeting load and would just like a chance to participate more in the education scene in Alaska.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Are there questions for Bonnie? Senator Elton.
Not a question of Bonnie. And Bonnie, thanks for your willingness to serve. I don't have Bonnie's resume or any information. In my Bonnie, sorry to bring a pause here, but
I can't find mine either.
In my packet, there were two piles. Ones were from the previous hearing that we didn't talk to, and then the other ones from this new.
Thanks,
pile.
Bonnie. The chair shared his with me.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you, Bonnie.
Well, thank you very much.
You betcha. We'll go now to Leona Oberts. Can you hear us, Leona?
I didn't hear that, but I can hear you now.
All right. Thank you. And you also want to serve on the Board of Pharmacy, and we have your resume. Please tell us why you are interested in serving in this particular capacity.
First of all, I think that it's a new challenge for me. It's an area that I don't have a lot of experience in, but I think all of us can agree that healthcare issues are very relevant and important to all of us. And as my parents are getting older and myself, I'd like to make sure that we can get the medicines that we need and that, you know, their care would be affordable. Also, I know that in the news lately there have been talks about some drugs that are being taken off of the market. And I just think there are a variety of issues that I would feel that I could maybe have a say in helping see that they're handled appropriately. And I also have served in my community for a number of years in different various ways and feel that I would be able to add to the board.
Thank you. I see that you worked here last couple years, and I suspect most of us know you from that. Any questions for Leona? Senator.
Mr. Chair, and Leona, this is Kim Elton. And as I was leafing through your resume here, there was an obvious question.
Okay.
I'm going to be embarrassed. I'm going to say I don't know that we've met, and you're probably going to remind me of the 12 times we have met. But it's kind of, I mean, based on your resume, it's kind of an awkward question. You worked in the Division of Elections.
Yes, I did.
And from 1992 to 2000.
Yes.
And at the same time, you held office in the Republican Party.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I'm sure glad that you brought that up because the times that I worked during election time, through those years, I had to resign any positions that I held in the Republican Party to not have a conflict in that area.
Okay, and if I could follow up, because it does show on your resume that you were District 11 Secretary from 1992 to 1994, but it also, and from 1998 to 2000, you were District 8 Secretary, and those are the years that, so you resigned from the Division of Election in those years?
Senator Elton, again through the chair, yes, whenever I worked at the Division of Elections, it was required that I resign my position, and so I served for part of the year, perhaps, as the Secretary during a district or precinct meeting, which is normally held in the spring, and I would work at the Division of Elections through August through November for those years.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair.
So, you resigned your position with the party during the times that you were working for the Division of Elections? Is that what you said?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right, any other questions? All right, thank you, and thank you for your willingness to serve, Leona.
Thank you.
We'll go now to Rebecca Neslin. Did I say that wrong?
No, you got it. That's great.
And it's Dr. Rebecca Neslin, and you want to serve on the Board of Dental Examiners. Is that correct?
I'm requesting reappointment, yes.
Ah, you're serving there now.
I am.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that. We have your resume. What has it been like serving there, and why do you want to continue?
Well, my initial interest was that it was the difficulty in obtaining a dental license in Alaska was an interest of mine, and I was interested in doing something to expediting this process and eliminating some of the redundancies that were required to get a license. And so I have been on that board, and it takes a while to figure out what's going on, and I feel like we have done the team that we've had there, we've worked really hard to deal with these issues as well as, you know, the other issues that you get to address on this board. So it's been a great learning experience for me, and I feel like I've accomplished we have accomplished those things that some of those things that I was interested in initially. Now my interest in staying on the board is because one of the hot issues in dentistry right now is dental health aid therapists in rural Alaska. And I am from Kodiak, and I'm also a commissioned officer with the Indian Health Service. And so I feel that the board really needs someone representing the rural Alaska with respect to this hot topic.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And just an aside, I think that all of us are concerned about what we understand are real dental health issues in Alaska and with our children, and particularly in rural Alaska. And I personally would appreciate any counsel you have on what, if anything, we can do and our position to help out with whatever the real problems with dental health are here in Alaska.
allowed me to address that briefly.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think some of these rural villages are so large, and yet they have they're not in beautiful places, and they're hard to access, and some of them don't have running water, and you know it's not a desirable place for a professional to come live. And we have been working on this. I've been in the Indian Health Service for 18 years here in Alaska. I was out for 3 years when I was transferred to North Carolina, but the rest of the time I was in Bethel for 3 years, and then I've been here in Kodiak for the last 13 years. And it's a tough issue. And we have, there are excellent dentists in the Indian Health Service dealing with this issue, and it's an unfortunate change is hard, and the American Dental Association and the Alaska Dental Society are very against these therapists coming to the United States, and because we don't have the structure there. But I think that they have been successful in New Zealand. It's been a successful program in Canada, and I think it can work here. And I think rural Alaska has some of the structures available, with the telemedicine to actually do this well. And so it's a tough issue.
Yeah, thank you. I was asking a more specific question about not dental health providers, but the issues with the children, and we can talk about that at another time. Thank you for your willingness to serve. Any
thank
questions?
You for
Oh, yeah, we're delighted. Senator Olson has a question.
Dr. Nestlin, just to make sure that I've got your position straight, what's your view on the dental health aid therapists? Are you for them or against them?
I support them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll go now to Randy Morton, who wants to be on the board of professional counselors. Can you hear us, Randy?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Yeah, thank you. We have your resume. Please tell us why you'd like to serve in this capacity.
I believe that I want to serve in this capacity because primarily I'm just interested in, I have a large interest in community service. That's one of the reasons that I'm a member of Rotary and the Chamber of Commerce here in Nome. Secondly, I believe I have the time that I can devote to this position and to bring me up to speed in this area, because it is an area that I would have to admit that I don't have a great deal of background in. I think the reason that I have the time is that I'm soon going to be an empty nester. I've got my last child that will soon be off to college, and think that I can readily adapt to new tasks. I've done this throughout my career. I've had a number of varied careers. I think provides or illustrates that I can take on new tasks and do well at such.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any questions for Randy? All right. Yeah, Randy, if indeed you do get appointed, and I suspect you will, an issue that will come up in the ensuing years here is whether or not the board you're serving on ought to be combined with the one for marriage and family counselors or therapists, and you might begin to think about that in the interim. But thank you for your willingness to serve. We'll go now to...
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the time to answer your questions.
And we appreciate your willingness to serve. We'll go now to Tashana Olson. Sorry for mispronouncing that. How should it be pronounced?
I don't use it. I go by Shawnee.
All right. Thank you, Shawnee.
You're welcome.
We have your resume. Tell us why you're interested in serving.
I've been a counselor in the state of Alaska for the past... I've been in the state for 24 years, going on 25, and I've been a counselor almost that entire time in the state. serving at the local Homer High School and now in a private practice, counseling is definitely my passion. It's what I like to do best. I grew up in a funeral home. My dad's a phenomenal grief counselor. And I like helping people. And Homer is very important to me in the community of Homer. And the lack of services for people statewide is phenomenal. So I'm very, very interested and intrigued by becoming part of a state board that would have opportunity to encourage licensure and encourage things like Senate Bill 177 so that LPCs could be recognized for their abilities and the need for these folks to serve the communities in Alaska.
Thank you. Any questions for Shawnee? Seeing none, thank you, and thanks for your past service and your passion. And I just ask you also to think about the issue of whether or not we should combine those boards in the future.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Now we'll go back to the Board of Dental Examiners, and we have Vicki Hoff. Is that pronounced right, Vicki? All right, Vicki, thank you. Why are you interested in serving in this capacity?
I think with my experience as being past president for 3 years of the Alaska Dental Hygiene Association, working in both private and public health as a hygienist for the past 7 years, I think this combination of experience provides me with a well-rounded perspective of dental issues in the state.
Well, thank you. Are there questions for Vicki? Vicki, do you think in the offices you've worked, have you seen much appears unprofessional or shoddy work by other people in the dental practices?
No, I can truly say I have not. Not in my experience, no.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Vicki? Thanks for your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
All right, back to the professional counselors, Dr. Kerry Turnbow.
That's correct.
Yeah, thank you. Please tell us why you'd like to serve in this capacity.
Well, I've been a licensed and LPC licensed professional counselor since the inception of the licensure.